This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a real honor to have in the studio with me Andrei Codrescu. He's a poet, essayist, founder of The Exquisite Corpse, the magazine, emeritus professor now of English and comp lit at LSU, weekly NPR commentator. It's a lot on his plate. He's got a new book out that we're going to talk about today, too, called The Poetry Lesson. Andrei Codrescu, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Well, thank you. Pleasure to be here. Crushed by my biography.
Yeah, I don't want that to be a weight on your shoulders. We're going to try to have fun. And you have fun in this latest book, The Poetry Lesson. You have fun when you write, which is a trick. How do you do that? Let's start there.
Well, my last semester committing the crime of teaching poetry, after 25 years, I decided to write about each class. I had a 3 to 6 p.m. seminar. And after, I would go to the coffee house and write about my students and about the day's lesson. And then without even wanting to, I started slipping down here and there down the slope of reminiscing about a lifetime spent doing this strange thing and remembering people and other years of teaching. And so it became both an exercise in humor, self-derision, some actual poetic sentiment, and the thing acquired a kind of gravity while I was chuckling.
Well, it is very fun to read. The plot is it's intro to poetry writing, and you're getting college kids who don't know jack about poetry, shockingly little about poetry, in one early section. You ask one of the students who her favorite poet is, and the only person she can conjure up is Shel Silverstein, who used to write those poetry, miniature little rhymes, childhood poems that we'd read. Lemonade Pitcher was one we used to tell the kids when they were going to sleep before. And so that was when she didn't seem to know. Ezra Pound was a measurement for her, it seems to me. But
right.
Or were you discouraged over time with the lack of knowledge of your students, or did it just come something you expected?
Well, no, I fully expected them to be ignorant, which is why I like teaching undergraduates, because they listened and they would do almost anything. It's true that a few years ago, if I asked them who their favorite poets were, the boys would always say Charles Bukowski, and the women would say Sylvia Plath. And maybe Shel Silverstein is actually an improvement, because they drink less and they don't commit suicide so often. So, you know, maybe actually they've achieved sort of a more balanced level of ignorance. But what's great is that you can tell them anything and they'll do it. So hence, I give them completely outrageous assignments and they proceed with a kind of sobriety. They do everything these days, like go to war and other things of that nature.
And you have a student who is enlisted in the Army or in ROTC or something in this book, The Poetry Lesson, Andrei Codrescu. And so you assign the students A through Z, practically, a poet that has the same initials that they have, great poets, many of them, and try to awaken in them some appreciation for poetry. And sometimes it works. But you also talk about, you have a passage in here where you talk about young people these days, and it's, there was a New York Times Magazine story about how stretched out not just adolescence is anymore, but young the 20s. I don't know what you call that generation anyway, but you seem to say that's not such a bad thing, that we've earned it in the United States if we've overcome the Protestant ethic enough that people can live without having to work in their 20s. Of course, the economy sucks right now, so that's not so much the case. Mm-hmm. But this is a rebellion against the Protestant ethic and a rebellion against boredom. Tell me about that.
Well, boredom is definitely an enemy, and it's been one for poets since Baudelaire wrote his famous poem To My Reader, in which he says, he says, well, there is a beast that's worse than them all, and it tears at your soul. I'm paraphrasing now. And it is boredom. Well, that, you know, certainly may have been the case in the Belle Epoque when Baudelaire was writing that. And since then, millions of people have been killed in some horrendously non-boring ways, and or maybe boring ways, I don't know. Things haven't changed in that sense, that we do seem to want to have more leisure and work for poetry. But, you know, just last night, I was looking, seeing these kids in pajamas and slippers walking down the main drag of the town, and I thought, well, did my generation do something wrong? Did we spare the rod? It appears that they do prolong adolescence and so on. What I did is give them these poets as ghost companions. I call them their ghost companions, and these are great poets who are dead. And so the idea was that they would live their lives every day by reading these poets to answer questions they had, even if they were completely trivial, like, what should I have for lunch? Then you open Ezra Pound and you find out what Pound thinks you should have for lunch, like, you know, a couple of cannons and some, you know, smashed statues, but whatever it is. But so, I mean, the degree of non-seriousness that that I introduced these works with actually fits their mode of looking at things, which is hurried and multiple ways of paying attention to things. And so I figured, well, this is an add to the sort of Googling of the universe by upsetting them. So I'm not sure what your question was. But
I don't know if I had a question, but that was a nice answer. I'm speaking with Andrei Codrescu. He is the author most recently of The Poetry Lesson. You may hear him on NPR doing weekly commentaries. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. One thing that you... tell me about Pound. Why is he still important? A lot of people hate Pound, of course, because of his fascism.
Well, they hate him because he was a fascist, but for poets he was important because he opened the field of writing to all sorts of things, translation, quotations from other writers, his own wacky economic ideas, whatever he could actually put in the poem and maintain the kind of music and the kind of unity of the poem, he put in there. So he gave us permission. So Pound means permission, whereas his pal Eliot, who was a conservative and an anti-Semite and everything else of probably of the same political stripe as Pound, though not quite as daring, Eliot put an end to things. I mean, to read Eliot is to say everything great was in the past. So if you're young now, forget it. There's nothing for you to do. But Pound opened up the field, and I think the poets appreciated him for that. They saved him from the gallows after the end of World War II, when he was indicted for treason for speaking on Italian radio. His Mussolinian propaganda, and the poets came to his defense and actually were able to commute his death sentence by declaring him insane and having him put at St. Elizabeth's in Washington. So, you know, he's done a lot for us in that sense.
I mean, Orwell liked Pound, too. You know, Orwell once said, you know, say what you will about his politics, Ezra Pound could sing.
Yes,
I like that line, from Orwell.
Well, his politics were not. I mean, he started out, you know, as a rebel against what he saw as a corrupt European world of parliament and managed system.
This is a civilization botched in its teeth.
Right, exactly. And so, I mean, how he got to Mussolini is not hard to see. A lot of European intellectuals of that period found some kind of solace in the kind of futurist fascist promises. You know, I mean, they didn't.
And Mussolini himself was like the editor of the Nation magazine of Italy at the time, early on, before he became a fascist. So there was something weird going on there. There's no doubt about that.
Well, things happen to ideologues, you know. I mean, this I remember very well the fact. I mean, there was a story that my good friend John Clark, who was a writer on anarchism and the professor at Tulane University, he shared a table, a libertarian table, with Newt Gingrich at Tulane University in the late 60s, and they, of course, went different ways. But When one speaks a certain kind of language, it is possible to go in different ways, I'm sure.
Well, it reminds me of a line I read of yours, Andrei Codrescu, in an interview with a really good interviewer, and you said many dictators starting writing poetry as students, and you mentioned Mao, Stalin, and Ho Chi Minh, but then you said they later preferred killing poets.
That may come from not being appreciated. I'm not sure.
Maybe it's like, if only they were published more.
Ho Chi Minh is not a bad poet. His nature poems are quite lovely. They're in the sort of Vietnamese Chinese tradition of appreciating cherry blossoms. Mao, I'm not so sure. And Stalin's poems actually don't read very well in translation. He was a theology student at the time he wrote them.
Well, tell me a little bit about your background. You fled Romania when you were 19 years old, I read. What are your memories of living under communist rule?
I left with my mother in 1965. We were sold by the Romanian government to Israel for $2,000 a head. The Romanian dictator Ceausescu at the time had a sweet deal going with Israel and West Germany. Ethnic Germans and Jews were allowed to leave because the respective states paid ransom. I think it was between 2,000 and 4,000 per head. The reason being, well, if you had gone to the university, I think they charged 4,000.
Oh, they had actuarials practically.
Yeah, my mother and I were both, they let us out for $4,000. So I figure I probably with interest, I never went to Israel, so I came to the United States. And so I probably owe the state of Israel with interest quite a bit of money, which I paid over the years in taxes, I'm sure.
Yes, since the U.S. government sends so much money over there every year. I've just been reading a book by Stephen Cohen, the historian from Princeton, about the people who were in the gulag and lived through it and then came out of it, and it's about their lives out of it. And one of the astonishing things that I just read was that some of them, upon having been tortured and kept in the gulag for decade or more and loved ones killed, come out and rejoin the party. Does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me. It's a version of the Stockholm Syndrome. I don't think... I mean, the camps and the prisons had their own systems of order. There were capos and there were trustees, and they to some extent wanted to come back into civilian life, and it wasn't the same Communist Party, for one thing, because it had reformed itself. I mean, after Stalinism, things got easier. I left Romania during the early days of the ascension of Nicolae Ceausescu, who was looked on favorably by most people then because he seemed to be anti-Soviet and he didn't take any sides in the Soviet-Chinese quarrel. He kept the Romanians out of the Warsaw Pact attack on Czechoslovakia, and there were no Romanian troops in Prague, although later he gave asylum to Alexander Dubček and turned him right over to the Russians who shot him. So
that's not a glorious thing to do.
No, it's not a glorious thing, but he was clever in a certain way because he was courting the West, and at the same time he served another purpose, which was to be an ambassador between China and the United States. He was helpful to the rapprochement between Nixon and Mao. And so he played a kind of politics that was big in for a little country and for a little guy, both physically and sort of mentally.
So he made a bigger role for himself.
Yeah, he did. But we looked on him hopefully, and there was a period of liberalization, there a thaw when there was an amnesty for all political prisoners in 1966, and then writers and artists were allowed to pretty much the kinds of freedom that the Czech artists took for themselves in Prague in 68. So, but of course that ended when he went to North Korea and visited Ho Chi Minh and decided that Romanians should really be Koreans.
Not Ho Chi Minh, did he visit? In North Korea?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm getting these guys mixed up. He was the Kim Il-sung, of course.
Yeah, the phone, yeah.
Right. The daddy.
Yeah. And now we're going to have the grandson, it looks like. So that's a weird kind of communism over there. Were you writing poetry in Romania before you came to the United States?
I was. And I was a precocious 16-year-old poet. I figured they got me out of the more onerous things they made us do in high school. And it gave me sort of an air of bohemian mystery that worked with girls. And there was also a time when we could suddenly read poets that had been forbidden for all the years of the harsher years of communism. And so the pre-war poets, Lucian Blaga, Tristan Tzara, the founder and daddy of Dadaism, was suddenly available to us. My generation started to get fresh air, and at the same time, people were smuggling in tapes of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones from the West, and so I was born into a kind of sense of generational freedom and the idea that I could escape from whatever it was. But I was writing poems that didn't sit well with, juvenile works that didn't sit well with the juvenile censors.
And so were you censored before you left?
Well, I had some discussions with our local party censor in my hometown.
So would they come to your door? How did that happen?
No, he called out, actually went to his office, which had a big red carpet that went all the way from the door. And he had an entire wall that was furnished to the complete works of Marx, Engels, and Stalin in red bindings. And he asked me about some vague symbolic references in one of my young works, and I felt very privileged to be so well read. You know, the censors, those guys could really read.
Well, they'll be the postmodern critics in today's academy, maybe. So,
well, the Homeland Security, I think, is hiring literary critics.
I don't think they're that smart. I hope not. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today, Andrei Codrescu, who's got this delightful book, The Poetry Lesson, out as his most recent book. When you got here, what writers influenced you? Were you influenced by Vonnegut or by Ginsberg?
Well, Vonnegut I hadn't read yet, but I read Howl by Allen Ginsberg in translation in Romania. It made a big, big impression on us, all us young poets. And
What was the impression? What impact? Can you describe the impact it had?
Well,
why was Ginsberg or why was Howl so such a big splash?
It gave us a sense that everything was possible, that we could be free, that we could be free to say things, and not just to say things, but free existentially. I mean, that it gave us an idea that there were people outside our borders who had taken the idea of being free to an incredible extent. And in Howl, Allen talks about drug addicts and mental hospitals and the police, and he's angry. And it's his angry prophetic voice that really liberated us. It liberated the Czech poets. It had the same influence in the Soviet Union. It almost had the same impact as it did in the U.S., where it was certainly influential in creating a whole generation of rebels along with rock and roll.
I mentioned Vonnegut, too, because in this book, anyway, you amuse the reader in ways that Vonnegut tried to. At least that's my impression. I talked with Vonnegut once, or maybe I read it in one of his later works where he said, maybe it was Timequake, I can't remember, but he said, you should write as though you're on a first date and you're trying to entertain and impress the person.
Man, was he right. That's wonderful. That's totally wonderful. Well, that's, I'm going to keep quoting him from now on. It does get harder not to repeat yourself and not to bore yourself. And I think the reason why poetry gets harder as you get older is because you've said an awful lot of things, you've been on a lot of first dates, and it's a tough gig.
That, and after the first date, it's the 3-month hurdle too. That used to be something for in dating where it was time to get serious or time to cut and run.
I never got that far.
Oh, you're being humble. you write about sex a lot. I'm just wondering how you're able to do that and keep your teaching job for so long.
Oh, you know, that's a great question, and probably the first time I've been asked publicly that. Well, the answer is that, you know, I really didn't mess around with students very much. I usually waited until they graduated. You know, occasionally I went drinking with my students, and, you know, who knows what went on, but apparently nobody complained because I got away with it. My good friend Jim Gustafson, great poet from Detroit who's no longer with us, but Jim has a wonderful line in one of his poems. He says, "Celebrate not getting caught."
One thing that I like about this book, The Poetry Lesson, Andrei Codrescu, is that you say, you know, year after year you deal with a new crop of students that come through, and you're trying to either get to them before something unexpected happens to them, or more likely the expected happens to them. What do you mean by that?
Well, most students now are on a pretty predetermined track. I mean, they go to their undergraduate, they go to graduate school, some of them. They go into the jobs that their daddies have prepared for them, certainly in the South. The law school is a good example of generations of graduates going into the same business. So all the predictable does happen. They, you know, marry at the right time. They have the right amount of kids. And until 2000 and something, they built the same huge houses that they didn't know the rooms of. And
not doing that now, though.
Now things are changing. You know, I mean, I think, you know, these things like recessions and depressions are good for us because times of prosperity are too loud. I couldn't write in New Orleans because of the noise of hammers and building and construction and all that, you know.
But it's so brutal stopped. For people, though. That's the hardship. And I don't know if people who are out looking for jobs or just got foreclosed on have time for poetry, or time to make poetry, much less to listen to it.
Well, yeah, they have time. If you got unemployment, you got time. I mean, there was a wonderful surrealist manifesto written in 1936 by André Breton that said poetry demands unemployment.
Well, I'm hoping people will read more poetry these days. You have a section in this book, The Poetry Lesson, by Andrei Codrescu, who's a poet himself. This isn't a book of poetry, but it's a funny little essay about trying to teach poetry. You've got a little discursive section, a couple paragraphs on, is poetry teachable? Because for a long time, people would say poetry isn't teachable, and you say it's teachable. Explain that.
It is teachable, but it is teachable as a mode of being, as a style of existence, less than as a way of writing.
But mostly it's taught as technique, so you have a different approach.
Right, completely different. I think most of these MFA programs, which have mushroomed like sores on the academic body of America, teach technique. They teach how to do this and that, and they do it by imitating various poets and so on. But I don't think that was the case for the great poets in the past. They looked at it as a way of living, as a state of existential questioning at all times. And so what language came of it is still important to us because those questions and those phrases stay fresh. I think writing poetry is nothing to it. I mean, you just, you know, anybody can write poetry. Anytime you write down two words, that's a poem. But how to live that and make that relevant and real is a whole different ballgame.
Well, how do you do that?
It's a mystical process in which you close your eyes and you put forth your hand and you touch somehow this part of people that's ineffable and inexpressible. And if you can do that and you find it and you also find the right person in the right conditions, you can transmit it.
But that sounds very mysterious and ethereal. It's all you got. Can you render it more material? I mean, you wrestle with big issues. You search for big emotions.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think that the trivial is just as good. I think everything is mysterious. We see it as banal because we get used to it and take it for granted. But I think the mystery is in every simple act of walking or breathing. And so it's really a matter of staying on your toes and being awake so that you can experience that. I don't think there's anything thematic about it or even issues. I mean, there's certainly, you know, emotions come into play, you know, anger and so on, and love and sadness and all those things listed on the list of emotions by psychologists. But I don't think it's about that. It is about mystery and about experiencing the world as mysterious and keeping an aura of mystery around the act of poetry itself, because it doesn't pay anything. You get no money for doing it. You get very little respect. You used to get some in the past, but not anymore. So you don't really get anything. The only thing you have is this idea that nobody knows what the hell poetry is, and nobody knows what a poet is. And so that mystery of that creative person and activity has to be maintained.
And part of it may be just trying to see things new, or pretending you've had a blindfold on for 15 minutes and take the blindfold off.
On the first date.
Yeah. Both would be blindfolded. That would be a hard date. Might be a better date.
It's a great idea. In fact, I recommend it. Make it part of the poetry lesson.
That's in your revised edition. Pop music, you write in here you don't listen to pop music. You have a little rant on that. Tell me.
Well, I don't listen to pop music. I haven't listened to it for a while, but I certainly like the theatrics of some of the pop stars. I love Lady Gaga's meat costume and her A1 scent. I thought that was just wonderful.
Was there A1 on that too? I didn't see that.
Yeah, they said, well, somebody wanted to know what kind of perfume she wore with her costume, and she said it was A1 sauce. But that's a pure Dada activity. Mm-hmm. I think Lady Gaga is brilliant in doing that. I have no idea what else she does. I know she sings, but I never heard any of that.
But you, the language, the words in the song seem to strike you, at least you say, in the poetry lesson Andrei Codrescu is so banal.
Well, the words are banal, it's true, and they've gotten more banal. I mean, there was a period, I think, of the sort of glory period of acid rock, where there was some kind of social and poetic significance to the lyrics of some songs, and there certainly is a lot of substance in the old songs and the spirituals and the songs that came out of a real existence. But for the most part, I think that sentiments remain banal and are the same about, you know, I love you and I had to leave and I'm sorry, and all of it, which is true and sad, but not great.
Well, more and more reason to read poetry and to read The Poetry Lesson by Andrei Codrescu. Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.